Hello and welcome to EDUCAUSE Now. EDUCAUSE Now is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. Visit www.morantechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain, and on this edition of EDUCAUSE Now, Greg Jackson, Vice President for Policy and Analysis at EDUCAUSE, and Brad Wheeler, CIO for Indiana University, talk about the future of enterprise IT. We also speak with Iris Lipinski, UK Director for CDI Europe. CDI's Apps for Good program encourages young people to use technology to tackle problems for social good in their community. Stay tuned. The EDUCAUSE 2011 Enterprise Conference takes place in Chicago next week. I recently spoke with two of the keynote speakers about the past and future of enterprise IT. Greg Jackson is EDUCAUSE Vice President for Policy and Analysis, and Brad Wheeler is CIO and Vice President for Information Technology for Indiana University. I started by asking what their upcoming keynotes are about. You're giving a presentation at the Enterprise Conference called Leading an IT Enterprise That's Out of Control. I'm wondering if you could, without giving too much away, I'm wondering if you could give me a little bit of a tease on that and exactly what is out of control and what are some of the issues surrounding what you'll talk about.
My premise is, there's two premises. Premise number one is that historically IT organizations in higher education have for the most part proceeded on the assumption, which was perfectly reasonable, that they controlled most of the major elements of what constitutes IT on a college or university campus. And my thesis is that if you start looking at each of the various pieces of that, what's true is that gradually each of those pieces is changing into one that's not terribly well controlled from the campus IT organization or sometimes from the campus at all. Let me give a couple of examples. So example number one is if you think about sort of servers and applications and data centers, all the stuff that's sort of behind the network that we work on. I mean, historically, campuses had big data centers and racks of servers and dedicated applications that did all of this stuff. And they might have bought the applications, but nevertheless, the financial system was a dedicated financial system, and the system that printed the checks was dedicated to that campus and so on. Now what you see, first of all, are the data centers have gotten very expensive, and so you see campuses, instead of buying servers and putting them in their own data center, they will either put them remotely or, more commonly, they will use virtualized servers out there in the cloud. Very true for research already, starting to be true for a variety of other things. But if you just think about the economics of data centers, that's bound to happen in a major way. If you're using virtualized machines that someone else is providing in their data center, there's an element of control that has now changed in a very fundamental way. If you look at the network, same thing. I mean, campus networks historically were the fiber and wire and then increasingly the Wi-Fi, all of which was deployed by the IT folks on campus. But these days, you walk around the typical campus, what you see is people using phones and individual devices that are talking to cellular networks, which happen to penetrate the campus. But there again, we're talking about a network that's no longer controlled by the campus or by the central IT organization. And that shift toward the end user device being a consumer device that people use for their own private purposes, that's a third kind of shift. If you add all of these up, fundamentally, we're talking about an IT environment where the role of the campus IT organization is to influence and guide it and perhaps sometimes to support it, but no longer does it control it. And that's what I mean by an IT enterprise that's out of control.
Greg Jackson's talk is entitled Leading an IT Enterprise That's Out of Control. So I thought I would pick up and say, well, what can we do to control it? I know the Kasnikovic paper of the early 2000s said, as we headed into the big administrative systems redo, we were going to spend collectively more than $5 billion to do it. And that was to move to a big generation of technology. I don't think anyone who's paying attention believes that we can take on the next decade by spending another $5 billion among higher ed. So my question is, with these changes Greg correctly notes and that we all know are happening all around us, what's going to be the approach of higher education in this decade?
Well, what are some of the biggest issues you see for administrative and enterprise IT?
Well, I think the biggest challenges for administrative and enterprise systems are fundamentally their cost and their agility to fit the needs of institutions. We just see over and over and over again where people thought they were going to change systems and they would reduce headcount and there'd be all sorts of savings. And by and large, that has just empirically been proven untrue. People may have changed their job title, but we ended up with a very large cost footprint in terms of software and maintenance for systems that are not very flexible or agile. And we've either had to own or rent very expensive expertise. So I just think the economics of this are not sustainable in this next generation. And I think what we have to do is figure out how, as an industry, we can approach this next decade. We learned a lot from the last one. You know, preceding it, we all built stuff separately. And that sure didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And we've learned from the previous decade. So my talk is really looking forward, looking ahead at the challenge of administrative systems, whether it's parking ticket administration or residence halls or big student systems or whatever it may be. I just don't see the finance in place to do it that way again.
What is the future of campus data centers?
If you mean the physical data centers, you know, big machines with lots of air conditioning, I mean, my view is there are many, many, many more of them than there is any rationale for. Michelle Wagner has been fond of pointing out that if you sort of take the 100 major research universities or the 150, pick your number, at least half of them either have recently built or are building either brand new data centers or major expansions to existing data centers, sometimes to house virtualized, sometimes to high performance stuff. And so you're talking about, you know, 50 to 70 such major facilities being built. And there's just absolutely no way that if you look collectively at what's going to be housed in them, there's just no justification for doing it that way. They're in the wrong place. They're too small. They're near the wrong power. They don't get economy of scale. They're managed by too many people. They have many too many doorways. You know, on down the line, no matter how you look at it, it's the wrong way to approach. And so my view is sooner or later, we're going to figure out that we simply can't afford to behave that way. And we're going to see immense consolidation into a relatively small number of very sophisticated regional, I would guess, data centers.
So I think we've got our big fat networks and we should be looking at aggregation. I do think some campuses will continue to build their own data centers who have core reasons to do so. Indiana has two. We've moved into a pretty big bunker one about a year and a half ago, but we already have scale with it because we're running it for 8 campuses and several other state agencies and now the Community College of Indiana. So it really is a game of do the economics support the capital cost and the operational cost to make a go of it. If they don't, it will be very difficult to justify investments in on-campus data centers.
Greg Jackson and Brad Wheeler, recordings of their keynotes will appear on this podcast feed in the coming weeks.
The EDUCAUSE Core Data Service is higher education's trusted source for comprehensive IT benchmarking data. Learn more at www.educause.edu/coredata.
CDI Europe is the European hub for the Center for Digital Inclusion, a global network of community-based centers working on digital inclusion, entrepreneurship, and community action. One of their biggest initiatives in London is the Apps for Good program. It's an education program that teaches underprivileged young people how to research, create, and market mobile apps that help their community. The program is headed by CDI Europe's UK director, Iris Lipinski. I recently spoke to her about Apps for Good and what higher ed faculty might learn from this initiative.
So what is the demographic of the kids taking the Apps for Good classes?
Our core focus now going forward is actually 13 to 17-year-olds in full-time education as our core audience.
How do you see Apps for Good as a mechanism for helping kids prepare for ongoing education, whether it be higher education or vocational?
Basically, what the course tries to do is to give them an exposure to actually a very broad range of different skills and different areas, how they could work or think about working in technology. So we now have sort of 5 steps, and I can quickly talk you through and explain to you what skills they get at each of the steps, and then maybe that answers your question. I'm not entirely sure.
No, that's perfect.
So the first step is around problem definition. So it's about thinking about a problem you have, trying to understand if there's a market, finding specific problems and reenacting them. So really trying to understand what the cause is, why there is a problem, etc. And that involves a lot of sort of critical thinking, critical learning skills. All the steps, young people go through those steps together as a team. So once they've identified that there's a problem and they've documented that, they've done a video about it, they go out and do market research to understand that even further. So there you have research and interview skills, analyzing the data, then really trying to understand what it is. They then put together a presentation and pitch that to experts. It could be professional designers or developers or business people. So you have an element of sort of being able to present your own thoughts, ideas in a very succinct way, and then being able to get feedback and to put feedback into context as well. The fourth step then is around stuff around technical feasibility and content to get over sort of the core roadblocks, but then also looking at business models, funding models. Where would you get the money for to sort of maintain an app on an ongoing basis? And viral marketing models. So how will people find out about what you do? Why should they spread the word, etc.? And only then they move to design. So the fourth step is design, wireframing, product design, doing storyboards, looking at user experience, etc. And then the last one is technical skills, i.e. build and test.
What sort of insights does being around the young adults bring to you regarding digital native generations' use of mobile devices?
There is sort of an interesting question about digital natives and what that actually means. At the moment, the young people we work with come from deprived, low-income communities in central London. And on the one hand, they're very good in using technology. So being on Facebook, connecting to your friends, using YouTube, they can all do that. Understanding technology and being able to create your own technology is a very different thing. So finding your way in an existing digital world and consuming stuff, yeah, they're all pretty good at it. There are some young people, in terms of basic understanding, there are young people who think the internet is Facebook. That's what they do, and that's what the internet is for them.
Well, the people I work with are mostly faculty of universities, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what faculty might think about in terms of being ready for the younger generation just coming into college and university.
I don't know, like one of the things I've observed, especially with mobile technology, if you want to use technology really, it actually changes the dynamics of learning quite dramatically. So we initially started out with desktop computers and everyone having their own computer. What we've learned is that using technology in that way is really harmful because it's a one-on-one thing, but people don't work together and they don't learn together in an effective way. So what we've moved towards now is using technology in a team-led environment. So every team have one mobile device and they work on one laptop together, unless they need to do specific tasks on their own. But the discussion and the learning is far more effective. And there's a lot of research actually about that. There was one thing by Sugata Mitra, which she did in Newcastle about sort of how people learn best. And it's actually when you talk to each other rather than sitting in front of a screen. So I think one thing as a teacher to understand is that probably your role is shifting from communicating knowledge to moderating. And I think quite a lot of teachers are already pretty good at that. So it's not a total change. It's more just focusing on your strength as a teacher. And that is like guiding people, mentoring them, asking questions, etc., rather than assuming that you know everything.
Iris Lipinski, UK Director for CDI Europe. You can find out more about Apps for Good by visiting appsforgood.org. If you'd like to find out more about the people and stories you hear on the podcast, visit our show notes at www.educause.edu/now. EDUCAUSE Now is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, morantechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.